and welcome to episode 13-1 of the Tech Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Desert Eagle Allen. With me tonight is Eric Blue Swim.
I'm not going to rage on Xbox One. Not going to rage on Xbox One.
Who's Xbox One?
Hmm?
Who are you talking about, this Xbox One guy?
Oh, you mean the VCR?
Yes, and giggling was Jeremy Lawman Lamont, giving me the courtesy laugh.
Giggling. Gomenasai.
That's good. And also with us tonight, Sage Samarage Morris Green.
I am going to rage about the Xbox One. You absolutely.
Guys, for sure.
In control.
Well, it's been 3 long weeks since our last show, and in that time, we've seen some exclusive titles. We played some new ones, played some old ones, and watched Microsoft make a substantial announcement. So there's a lot to talk about, so let's dive right in. Start things off with a new feature. Now, a number of people wrote in asking about our opinions of the Xbox One launch. So we are an opinionated bunch, and I'm sure a formal discussion would probably cross the 3 or 4 hour mark. So in the interest of brevity and keeping things quick and lively, I wanted to offer a format which I'd like to call 90-second analysis. So as the name indicates, each host will have an uninterrupted minute and a half. You're free to interrupt me to provide their breakdown of the presser. And then after, let's have a short, probably heated discussion. Sounds good?
Sounds good.
Sounds good to me.
Who wants to kick it off?
No, Robert does.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of glad I waited to do this, because if you review my Twitter feed or caught me right after the presser, I was in full-on snark mode. Fortunately, having an extra week to sort things out really kind of clarified things for me. Now, first, I think we know that the hardware market can be tough. I've seen the effects of game industry from the hyperdimension of 2D games. Okay, I'm kidding there. Seriously, an amazing piece of hardware like the Vita has kind of struggled, and then another piece of hardware from Nintendo, a company with a very good reputation, has floundered. So instead, I think Microsoft said, winning this console generation is thinking small. We want to win big. And since hardcore gamers are still a relatively niche audience, Redmond is I think really swinging for the fences. They've always wanted a set-top box, because you know, with that there's multiple revenue streams. There's TV, movies, music, games, what have you.
There's and TV, television.
Yes,
TV,
I saw
sports,
that.
TV,
too.
TV.
Halo.
Sports.
ESPN.
Looking back, you're stealing my 90 seconds. Now, looking back
at
the press coverage of the Xbox One, I think a lot of gaming sites crucified it. Some defended it, but the mainstream press wasn't nearly as impassioned. Most of their coverage listed kind of the feature set and abilities. Now, in hindsight, I don't think this was Microsoft's flaw. I think, you know, Gen Pop people, they connected, they knew Halo, they knew Spielberg, Madden, Call of Duty. And for them, you know, this event kind of trickled down in the press into something interesting. You know, the press saw it and they wrote about it for, you know, Forbes or what have you. And instead, I think Microsoft's flaw was not restating multiple times, this is what they should have said, as for games, we have a multitude of titles that will just blow you away at E3. Stay tuned for that. They didn't say that. So the hardcore audience was disappointed. Now, I think because of social media, we have this ability to surround ourselves with people who share the same sentiment. So if I don't agree with Jeremy, I unfollow him. And so we create our own little echo chamber. Sorry, Jeremy.
And no, that's true.
I couldn't help but feel disappointment with the Xbox One unveiling, and that feeling was validated by my Twitter friends. And then I got to thinking, wait, why does Microsoft owe me anything? If they want to build the ultimate TV box, and I could care less about the medium, why am I angry? Shouldn't I just be apathetic and move my attention, you know, towards a product that better suits my needs? Maybe the PS4. So where does this sense of entitlement, you know, kind of come from? Well, that said, one last thing I want to touch on before I leave Microsoft defense mode forever. I'm sure Microsoft has a few interesting things up their sleeve. In case in point, the used market. If speculation is true, they just cut a multi-billion dollar multinational market leader right out of the equation. Now, GameStop went from running things to getting what Microsoft basically sees fit to give them. You know, they got bullied right out of the schoolyard. Now, here's the weird thing. GameStop, you know, obviously has a lot of power. Why haven't they publicly leveraged it? In fact, they did the opposite. Right now, if you go on their site, they're running ads and pre-orders for the Xbox One instead of boycotting a piece of hardware that will probably make them, you know, very little money selling. The hardware doesn't make a lot of money. So something doesn't add up, and so I don't think we have the complete picture. in place yet. 90 seconds, boom, done.
All right, so next, because I think I'll transition. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Jeremy, you can go next, but to be fair, Robert, I think that was a little over 90 seconds, so I think everyone should get a little over 90 seconds.
Okay.
Whatever. Sorry, man, you set the scope. Jeremy, I think that was more like two or three minutes.
I did say TV, 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 so I think that's weird.
No, I didn't count that. I think you got 2 or 3 minutes even without that, so Jeremy gets 2 or 3.
Well, I don't know that I'll take that long, but I think that in the sort of spectrum of how we'll go, Robert may be a little more positive. I'm sort of neutral on this, because to be honest, they didn't really show very much. I think that their questions were their presentation was mostly questionable, if anything. I don't really have a problem with anything in their announcement. Not the TV, not the television, not the TV or the TV, or the sports, or the sports, or the dog, or the Call of Duty, or the dog. But I find that it was just a very weird setup for them. So first of all, you mentioned E3, like they're going to show games at E3. I don't really see why they felt the need to get into this like 3 weeks beforehand, you know. Not only that, because you know there's nothing wrong with that. But the other thing about it was they invited all the games press to come see this thing. They aired it live on Spike TV, stream it on Game Trailers, invite all of the game journalists, and then they sit them down and talk about TV, 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 television, TV, sports. That was really weird to me. Like I don't have a problem with the TV or the sports or any of that, but it's just. It's like they set themselves up for this weird like failure. I don't doubt that they will have games. There will absolutely be games for this box. There's no way they won't have games. But why would they set this all up and then be like TV, TV, TV? The other thing that I found that was interesting about this is they from a TV standpoint, they are hitching their wagon pretty heavily to cable television. The only reason that I even think about this. Is because this is the weekend that Arrested Development aired on Netflix. And, you know, the new season 4 of Arrested Development, which is funny, by the way. Everybody go check it out. So everybody's, like, I and at least 3 other people that I know of have all sort of been raising anew the discussion of, you know what, do I really need cable? Why not cut cable? Right. And they're making this thing like this cable pass-through box. And that just, I mean, and probably they'll be able to do some other stuff too, but they are, like, really heavily hitching themselves to cable. And maybe that's good, but... Cable subscriptions are down, and I don't know that they're going to go any other way than down at this point. So I found that kind of weird as well. Basically, I'm still willing to wait and to listen with Microsoft. I think I've been pretty clear. They only need to say, you know, the 4 words, free basic online service to me. And that's all they need to say to me. Yeah, I know, but I'm not willing to count them out quite yet. The other thing, and we'll talk about this when we all get to talk together, but the you know, 2 or 3 days or 4 days or, you know, the time since they had this reveal has been really strange, you know, with all the questions that they've brought upon themselves that are, you know, they're just digging themselves this really weird hole. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. But generally speaking, I'm kind of neutral on it. I don't have a problem with it. I'm willing to wait and see what they have to say. I just find the entire setup just very, very strange. And I don't know why they put themselves in that position.
Can I just jump in and say something real quick to Jeremy? Back last year's E3, when Nintendo presented, they showed the Wii U. You know, they stopped the whole show and said, oh, yeah, well, what about our 3DS? We are going to have a separate presentation. Now, I think that there's a method to that madness, and that is they are worried about social media, and they want to continue the message. They want little tiny bursts to keep the Twitter feed, to keep Facebook going. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but, well, you're saying
so,
that...
So they trickle out information.
They did all of this, or...
Well, they're trickling out information, so you don't get one kind of lump sum. Instead, you get little bits of info for a long
time. And I am totally about that. In fact, I'm probably the only person who noticed that I said this on Twitter, but when the, Sony actually released a little thing, I can't remember if it was shortly before or shortly after, with blurry, weird, quick cut right. images of their, yep. which is really weird.
It was a little before.
Yeah, a little before. And then they did the PS4 logo there, and it used the PS3 font, the PS3 Slim font. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, and I thought out loud to the world, why not do another trailer before that with just the new font? You know, why not release a new font for this thing? Because I bet you could get at least a little bit of mileage out of just a new font, which I know sounds totally terrible and stupid.
I'm a Spider-Man font.
Yeah, exactly. But just like you said, I mean, the process of trickling and keeping keeping the conversation at a low hum the entire time. Yes, I agree with that. But this was just, I mean, like I said, they invited games people. They, you know, got Jeff Keighley out there and, you know, streaming it on Spike and Game Trailers and all of that. And then, you know, and they even showed some games. To be honest, they showed some games. They showed sports games.
Keeley out there.
Dorito, yeah. Well, exactly.
He was in his throne.
On his throne of Dew. Anyway, so
Point is about cable TV. I'm in agreement, but I also think a younger generation, they want to cut the wires. I see a lot of people watching things on their tablet, watching things wireless, and not necessarily staying at home and watching, you know, television. But they want to watch things. Yeah, Price is Right. And today,
okay. So let's now
intelligent TV.
Hold on, let's climb up for just a minute. So Sage or Blue, one of you guys go.
Yeah.
That was 5 minutes for the record.
I
don't count that as my time. I stopped.
It's true. I'm just saying. I think we need an actual buzzer if we want to do the whole 90-second thing. Okay. Blue, go.
You said you were going to be a minute.
Oh. I'm just pointing it out.
1 minute wonder. Go.
So as promised, hopefully this is a minute. So here's my problems with Xbox One. Unlike the previous two speakers, I fucking hate this piece of shit bullshit machine. and here's why. Let me tell you why. So the not being able to share games, like, fine, they cut out GameStop. Great. Fuck GameStop. I don't like GameStop either. But what it really means is that you can't share games with other people, like your siblings, your friends. You can't go play next gen Halo at your friend's house because the four of you want to play. You have to pay a fee to unlock the game, which is just, that's disgusting. Like, that's worse than in-game buying of things. That's like, no, we're never gonna let you profit.
They did tell you, I'm not trying to defend them, but they did tell you you could log in to your Xbox Live and play it at your friend's house.
Okay, foul, Robert. She gets to keep talking.
Fuck.
We can go back to that after if you want.
Yes.
So, the having to always be on the internet, lots of people do not have solid internet connections, like a lot of people. It's not a few people. It's not a couple of poor teenagers who live in the ghetto. There's a lot of people who don't have a consistent internet connection or use their internet at work or whatever. So, the idea that you have to be able to log on at least once a day is like, they're just not conceiving of the fact that, no, not everyone lives in an ivory tower and has millions of dollars and has consistent internet connection all the time. Fuck you. The fact that it's not backwards compatible is really disturbing. Like, that's a money-making bullshit. Like, I know, it's different architecture, I get that, but they could have figured out a way to at least make games really cheaply or free accessible on the Xbox Live connected to your account. They've made no mention of that. If they're listening and they haven't thought of that, maybe they fucking should, because not having backwards compatibility is, again, disgusting. The fact that the Kinect bundle has to be, like, the bundle is there and it's on all the time. They said that they're not spying on people, that it's just listening for Xbox on as a term. If they're listening for that command, then it's listening. Like, if it can pick up a cue at all, that means it can pick up any other cues. So that's just fucking bullshit. Along with everything else. And I don't care, Robert, if they have a plethora of games, because true gamers who aren't just interested in the next big gamer flashy bling thing, who want to play their old games, who want to be able to play games like with their friends, they're all being cut out by this piece of crap.
The end.
You'll be all able right, to Blue. Play your old games. Sage.
Wait, just wait. Oh, damn. Write that down. We'll come back to it. Blue, go.
You're just going to have to pay for it.
Which is bullshit. Blue, go.
Well, I'll be honest. You know, what they have done with the interface looks impressive. The idea of it being an all-in-one cable box is nice and impressive and all, but let's be perfectly honest here. There is something called the Roku box. It gets Netflix, it gets Hulu Plus, it gets Crackle, Crunchyroll, etc., etc. Why the fuck do I need another box to play brand new games that aren't really mine if I buy them used, and all this bullshit? I don't like it. I hate it. This, you know what? We have a question in the mailbag about the appeal of retro games, and this is going to segue into that later on. But everything the Xbox One is doing, from the DRM bullshit to, I guess, always having Kinect plugged in. Yeah, I have to always have Kinect plugged in, is my understanding. It's just against everything that I stand for as a gamer. I play retro stuff because I can buy used games for cheap and get this exact same experience that I had back in 1992 or 1995 or whatever. Used games, dead. I don't care what they say about a stupid fucking fee. Xbox One, used games, ain't going to happen, because nobody's going to deal with that shit. No one's going to want to have to pay $45 or full retail price or whatever just to play a used copy of the game. It's practically going to be one of those AOL free trial discs once you get down to it. You know, and I mean, let's face it. Like Sage was saying about having a live microphone and a camera connected to an always-on system in the middle of your living room, it just begs to be turned on while you're fucking on the couch.
Wow.
No, Blue, actually, that's totally what I thought, too.
That's their new revenue stream. You can watch your neighbors. Mm-hmm.
It's like I said on Twitter. Xbox One is watching you masturbate. Specifically, it knows your wrist angle, yanking speed,
yeah, and the
ejaculation distance,
trajectory,
and fapping material. I mean, it is exactly what this is.
Jeez.
Actually, that would be true since it's like a go-through cable box. It would know exactly what you want to watch to masturbate to. That's disturbing. Mm-hmm. Fucking Microsoft. You know what? I'll add to that. It's bothered me so much that even though I didn't want to get a Wii U, because though I think it's, you know, it's fine, I have nothing really against it, but I didn't really want to pay for it. Now I want to go out and buy one because I absolutely will not be buying an Xbox One or a PS4, and I'm pretty much done with consoles until they don't do that anymore. Like, I will be an exclusive PC gamer, which is fine because isn't Steam making a console, like a TV-based kind of peripheral anyway.
Yeah. First time I turned off my view in months was right after the Microsoft presser. Coincidence or not, I don't know.
So can I just mention, Sage, not to pick on Sage, but you just brought up in the attack on Microsoft and the you know, non-used games, DRM sort of thing, you brought up Steam as an alternative, which is exactly that.
But let me tell you why it's different. I know what you're going to say, because you're going to say that it's locked to your account with Steam.
Yes.
But here's why it's not the same. It's not the same because with computer gaming, there is a tradition, a long-standing tradition, and until there was laptops, of you're at home. And so if people are going to want to come and play, they either have to bring their own machines, which became easier with the, you know, invent of laptops. They either have to bring their own machines over, or else you guys play with each other over the nets, because computers tend to be more sophisticated and can handle it, and it works a little better, and servers aren't always crashing like they are with Xbox right now, because they are, et cetera, et cetera. Console games, like I've always argued since the beginning of me being on the podcast, that the primary difference, you know, people argue controls, and I like the controls, but whatever, all of that aside, because that's a preference. The biggest difference between console gaming and PC gaming is that typically if you're PC gaming, you're alone and you're connecting with people solely over the net. Whereas with console gaming, four of you could sit down and play Left 4 Dead or play a Mario game or whatever the fuck it was, you know, pick your genre, pick your timeline. You could play a game with four other people in your living room, and it was a more like in-person, in real life, interconnected thing, or Dance Dance Revolution. Whereas PC gaming was always sort of separate. It's part of the culture. But now they're taking console gaming and they're making it a, you should be alone and you should live in your house and you should always be connected to the internet. You should be fine with the fact that we're watching you and you should only connect with other people over the nets. And by the way, if you do want to connect with someone in real life, God forbid, you or they have to pay money to unlock the game on their console. I mean, it's gross.
You know, there was one thing that you brought up a few minutes ago. You also mentioned the PS4 in the anti-DRM talk.
Mm-hmm.
There was a rumor going around that Sony was thinking about it, about implementing retail game DRM, but they've seen all of the backlash that Microsoft has been suffering from, and they're actually, according to rumors and insiders and what have you, they're actually considering not including retail DRM with the PlayStation 4. And if you ask me, if the Xbox One, dumbest name ever,
I concur with that. That is one thing I did not say, but I agree with you. The Xbox One is the, of all of the choices that they had to pick, it was the worst possible
it's
name.
So stupid.
Anyway, worst continue, sorry.
Ever. Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, if the Xbox One launches with retail game DRM and the PlayStation 4 doesn't, Microsoft is going to be doing Wii U numbers. And the PS4 is going to beat the fucking shit out of it.
You know, if that does end up being true, then Sony will have done the first brilliant thing I've seen them do in about a decade.
Since the PlayStation.
Because here's why. Sony, the company, not PlayStation. Sony was Sony was the company that wanted to initiate the whole DRM thing on DVDs and Blu-rays back in the day. Like, they're the ones that came up with that. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, no, you can't do that because I want to be able to take my fucking DVD movie and watch it at my friend's house. And that, and the same backlash. And so they were like, okay, fine, we won't do that because everybody's pissed off about it. They're the ones that fucking came up with it. So if that is what happens, then they're brilliant because it means they sucked Microsoft into saying they'll do it. And now they're like, we're the good guys. We're not Microsoft. We won't do that.
I am waiting for the moment. You know, there's always the discussion that used games hurt developers. And I'm waiting to see how much money Microsoft actually, you know, throws at them for the sale of a used game and if that changes any of the conditions of our industry. I don't think so. I think they're going to be having the lion's share of the profits.
Who, Microsoft?
Microsoft, yeah.
Yeah, but think about this. Microsoft is not just deciding to do this because they think it would be fun. Right?
No, they're doing it
to make money because they're greedy, profiteering barons.
They just stepped on GameStop. Said, hey, you guys are selling used games? I'm going to take over that market because I can.
Yeah, but think about this, though. Microsoft does not make money from the sale of new games either. I mean, they, unless it's something that they published.
Yeah.
Think about
there's a licensing fee for every game that they make. Yeah. They make money.
Yeah, I mean, they get revenue up and down and however it works, but the people who have the biggest interest in controlling aftermarket sale is not Microsoft, it's not the platform holder, it's the game publisher.
Mm-hmm. But Jeremy, the point of anti-monopolizing society, which in theory we have, only not really, because everything's owned by the same like five companies, but in theory, anti-monopoly stuff is about the fact that you play the price war competition. You don't completely cut out, like, I hate GameStop, I don't care, okay? But they completely cut them out by being like, well, won't be a possibility in the future, fuck you.
Yeah,
like,
but that's not quite the right analogy because they're not a monopoly. I mean, there are other, Ouya just came out, get an Ouya. I mean, there's all kinds of competition to control prices.
That's true, but as far as the game, like, as far as the console game purchasing crossover, which has always sort of been a tenuous boundary, as far as that crossover goes, if minus Nintendo, but Nintendo sort of does all their own shit anyway, and who cares, and they have a marketplace where they do sell used games for cheap, so they already sort of have played that game. If the other big ones, which are Sony and Xbox, if Sony doesn't back down and if they both decide that actually they are going to cut out any possibility of used gaming, they have entirely put GameStop out of business, pretty much. At least in 10 years.
GameStop is a middleman who's inserted themselves like a parasite into an...
Well, that's fair, but what about other
games? They have no skin in that game. They have no skin in that game.
But what about not GameStop? What about other game stores that are not the bullshit parasite that is GameStop, but they still fill that role?
You know who really should be looking at this is like GameFly or, you know, companies that specifically deal with rentals. But, you know, here's the other thing, though.
Redbox as well.
Yeah,
Redbox.
It's not that Microsoft, I don't even think it's that they, I mean, you know, the way they have been spinning it, it's not that they don't want to eliminate used games. They have gone out of their way to say that the Xbox One specifically will allow, you know, playing of used games.
Yeah, for price.
Bullshit.
Exactly, that's the thing.
But that's the part that's bullshit. I already bought your fucking game.
Is it's going to balance out. They're obviously not going to sell the used games at astronomical prices. Right, because one of the things.
Of course they are.
They're going to maximize their profit, but if they're priced too high, no one's going to buy them. So who wins?
Yeah, but that's not true, Robert, because the people who buy fucking Xboxes are the Gramer frat boy bullshit kids who have money coming out of their assholes, so they can afford to make it those prices, because they'll put out the, like, you know, super edition of all the previous Halos in their used games, and you should be able to play these backwards compatibly, but since you can't, we're going to sell them to you for $60 for all four of them. Isn't that a great deal? No, it's not a fucking great deal, because I already bought your goddamn games to begin with.
I don't know that the people... I mean, think about what you're saying, though. People who don't buy used games have money coming out of their assholes. I mean...
I'm one of those, I guess.
A huge percentage of Xbox's market are sort of affluent, upper-middle-class white kids who can afford to continue to buy or ask for Christmas or pay for games, no matter whether they're new or used, at whatever price. And if Xbox banks on that, which they obviously are to some degree because they assume everybody has the internet, which isn't true, if they're banking on that, then they can afford to. I mean, I'm not cutting you off entirely and saying, like, no, they're going to charge full price. But I don't think they're going to make them reasonable, because I don't think they give a shit, because everything they've done points to, we want to make more money because we can.
Yeah, look at digital prices. Or I mean, my God. I mean, some of the retail games that you can get for $20 are $40 or $60 on Xbox Live. It's ridiculous. Exactly. They don't lower the prices like Steam does.
No, they don't lower the sales. Microsoft
they lower
has,
the prices like GameStop does.
I just bought $5.
Microsoft has better sale prices than fucking Xbox at Live.
I have never seen so many people put so much energy into defending a $5 discount on used games that completely cuts the creators of the content out of the equation totally.
Because you think Microsoft is going to share so much of that profit?
Even before we get to that logic, I mean, just think about what we're saying right now. I'm not disagreeing with you totally. I don't know that this is necessarily a shot across this bow or that bow, but I feel like personally, my personal core belief in this entire discussion is that the people who create the content, the people who work on the IP, the people who actually develop and create the things that we enjoy consuming, they should probably have some, you know, financial benefit for making that stuff.
I agree.
And, you know, GameStop, the way the used game market works right now, they are not necessarily being compensated in what is an equitable manner for the people who are actually consuming the content that they created. And I feel like a healthy ecosystem is one in which the people make the content, the companies create the content, or the developers, the studios, whoever it is, create the content, they put it out there for sale, and when somebody consumes that content, that developer, that creator, that person who took that risk or you know, whatever it was they decided to bank on, whatever, you know, whether the idea was a crazy idea or a traditional idea or whatever, the market can decide how much that is worth directly to that person by either buying it or not buying it.
Jeremy, I agree with you.
Publishers would take a chance instead of having $50 game all the time. And I think Ubisoft is, and I'm, one of the things I'm going to be talking about tonight is the Call of Juarez Gunslinger. And that is priced at $15, much like Blood Dragon. 6-hour experience, and really a cool idea, and a great alternative to that $60 package retail.
And completely digital.
Something that goes directly to Ubisoft and something exactly. like more.
And they will know directly, based on the revenue that they gain from the sale of that product, whether it was a good gamble or a bad gamble, or whether the market is interested or not interested. And it allows them the wiggle room, it gives them the latitude that they need to really understand what is worth making or what is not. And in my opinion, when they have that fiscal feedback, they will have the ability to better decide what kinds of things are worth taking those risks on, because they directly see the benefit or the loss of those
absolutely.
Things.
And Jeremy, I entirely agree with you on that. But there's a difference between Ubisoft doing that as a publishing company and the console on which you play things deciding that they're going to create a price point, whatever it is. I mean, I agree that arguing over it at this point, since we don't know what they're going to charge for used games, might be a little academic. But the idea that the umbrella, I mean, you know, Xbox is a console, which makes them the umbrella that encompasses all those different publishing companies. And so if they make these restrictive movements, then that changes how everyone else below them has to interact on that playing field. I mean, I love Humble Bundles for that reason, because you're giving the money directly to the people that have put the game forth, that have taken the risk, that have decided to, you know, make the game and put all the effort into it. I love those opportunities to actually get them their money. But Xbox One isn't going to be doing that.
But the GameStop model is exactly the opposite of that.
I said fuck GameStop. I don't give a goddamn about GameStop. I don't care if they go out of business. What I care about is that Xbox One is introducing a whole slew of sort of lacking in integrity practices, which it seems like is where the console market is going, which is really disparaging for someone who's been playing console games since she was four.
Yeah, I mean, my personal belief on this is that nothing that I have heard from Microsoft, and like I said, I'm fairly neutral up to this point about what they've announced, but nothing that they have said to me, it seems anything underhanded. There's nothing, I don't even think there's anything necessarily even greedy about this.
Are you kidding?
I am not kidding. I'm being absolutely serious.
How do you think that?
I'm telling you why I think that, because I think that, especially from
you don't think they just went up to GameStop, said, fuck you, give me your lunch money?
What do they owe GameStop?
But that doesn't mean
they don't owe
them
anything. And
they're not a bully because they don't owe GameStop something. That's not what makes you a bully. That's not what makes you greedy or not. What makes you greedy or not is, hey, how can we make the most money possible?
Think about this. How can they make the fairest money possible?
This isn't fair money. They're taking all the money.
No, they're not. They're not taking all the money. They are.
You think they're going to turn around and give like 75% to the people who made the games?
They can do whatever they want to with it.
They're not going to.
It doesn't matter what they do with it.
I'll bet you five purchasable games on the new fucking Xbox.
No, listen, like I said, the other thing about it too is from the standpoint of a platform holder. I mean, my opinion, just to go back to the thing you said earlier about what price they'll set on it, expect the worst, hope for the best. That's my motto. Expect that the game will be $60. You know what I would do if I don't know, I don't want to implicate myself here, but what if the disc, because they've said the disc just contains the bits. For them, they've basically said that the disc is basically just a proxy for the download, right? Mm-hmm. Send the disc around as much as you want. Install off the disc. What you get from that is the demo. And then if you want to buy that, then you can decide whether you want
to buy that. That's bullshit. I should be able to loan a game to my younger brother who doesn't live with me. Like, I should be able to lend the game to a friend of mine. That's not anti-piracy. Piracy is making copies for other people. There is no law against lending your game to someone or taking it to their house and playing it there.
Yeah, but so just from that standpoint, I don't feel that Microsoft owes anything to GameStop, and I don't feel that Microsoft owes it.
It's nothing to do with GameStop.
Whatever. But I mean, it's all the same thing about what are they obligated to us to do? They're obligated
to be integrous, good providers of gamage.
But the language that's being used in this is very like, you know, like, oh, it's DRM, it's bad. Oh, and they'll have integrity to let us have our used games. Like, I feel like there's just this language that's being used that paints it in one light or another. And I feel, like I said, I'm pretty neutral on this. The other thing of it too is that from the standpoint of a platform holder, they have a responsibility. They have a responsibility as part of the relationship that they have with the companies that publish on their platforms to protect the interests of the people or the companies who are publishing on their platforms. And I think that this is a move to accommodate that and to try and make sure that their business partners in this business transaction are able to realize legitimately the financial the recompense that they are due by investing in the Xbox platform.
But right? What if nobody buys it?
Before we wrap things up, I got a question for Sage and Blue. Why are you guys so mad? Why not just say fuck it? I'm picking up the PS4.
And can I put a spin on that question?
That's pretty much what it is.
No, I'm asking you why. Why are you so angry?
Yeah,
I don't get it.
So angry.
I'm not buying an Xbox One. Move on. I just don't understand the rage.
Well, for me, I'm a passionate gamer. I mean, okay. If it's something's good, I want to play it. I don't care what platform it's on. Mm-hmm. And when I see bullshit like this that makes me not want to pick up the system, it effectively cuts off any potential game I'd want to play on it because I don't want to have to deal with that bullshit.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, like I said, I mean, I'm a retro guy. It's like, I just like being able to put the cartridge in and playing it. I primarily, I'm an offline gamer because I don't want to have to deal with, like, always on bullshit and Skype and DRM and all this crap. I play old games so I won't have to deal with that bullshit. I just want to put the disc in and play it. And any system that stands in the way of that is not a system I care to support. And when it's something like Microsoft, I've been a hardcore Xbox.
Why not just keep playing the old retro games? Bring out the SNES.
Exactly what I'm going to do. But I mean,
it's
the future. It's like I'm getting cut off from the future because they're doing something stupid that I don't support.
Right. I think that's a big part of it is that, I mean, if you're a gamer, then part of you enjoys technology and evolving technology. That's an exciting thing. Mm-hmm. Going from, like I said, I've been playing since I was four. Going from Nintendo to Super Nintendo is like, oh my god, cool. Going from Xbox to 360, there were some glitchy things, but it was still like, oh my god, cool, whatever. There's some things I don't like, but mostly cool.
But Microsoft is the only game in town. You could go Sony.
No, I understand. You could go PC. But...
You can go portable.
Robert, I mean, it's not,
you can go Android, iPhone.
Yeah, but Robert, it's not that open-ended, because and you know this, because the problem with that is that not all games go to all platforms. If they do in the future, phenomenal. Then I won't care at all. Well, I'll care that I'll...
A tipping point. If there's enough Forza, I don't know what Microsoft games you really enjoy, then the you will purchase the console, but I don't understand.
No. But hell see, no. but that's the thing, Robert. I won't, because you're today in our society, the only speaking voice you have is where you spend your money. So I absolutely will not give my money to Microsoft, because and that's the other thing. Like, you ask why I'm so upset, because there are a bunch of really fucking stupid people who are just going to buy it because it's the next new thing. So Microsoft won't get that message that, like, hey, we don't like this as much as the 360. The people who are really passionate and invested in gaming.
Well, maybe that evolves and turns into something else. Turns into, super machine.
Right.
And that's fine. And they can go do their thing, and I can play my little, Disgaea on the PS4.
Yeah, I mean,
and I'm a happy camper.
I don't see how the Xbox One, I mean, you can still play retro games. I'm sure they'll release remakes, old version. I mean, they've done it for the Xbox 360. Yep. That stuff will still be available. If people are going to buy it, they'll put it on the market. They want people to buy it.
So here's why, guys. It's a limit. It's a limit to gaming, because games are not available on every platform, so it means you're not going to be able to play some games. Mm-hmm. It's a cutoff from the future. I think Blue put that really articulately, and I think that's a very big part of it. And the other part of it is that old machines break. And if old machines break and then you don't have an option to play your old games, then you're very disappointed and you're left unhappy. So you're asking why we're angry. That's why we're angry. And we feel like, as customers who have, loyally supported, even if it's not a loyalty thing, even if it's just those other things, you feel like, cool, I've grown up with this company and I've, been a part of what's going on. And now it's like a betrayal's too strong a word, and I'm not trying to make it that personal.
It's creative differences.
It's a decision that leaves someone who's an avid gamer and has those three other interests vested in mind. It leaves them sort of in a lurch, and that's why it's upsetting.
And I think you guys brought up some really good points. I do want to mention, since you mentioned a lot of people will still be buying it, apparently Blockbuster, the United Kingdom Blockbuster, says that the Xbox One already has broken all pre-order records set in the company's entire 24-year history.
Oh, God.
UK,
stop doing this shit.
People are stupid, non-thinking sheep, and this is why I don't want to live on this planet.
Well, happy announced a PS4.
Same bullshit.
Well, and I also want to say that you bring up some good points. I was really surprised about backwards compatibility not being a thing. I thought, if anything, that was going to be the one thing that Microsoft would have over Sony, they didn't do it. And that's the other thing too, is with all of this, all of the talk about fucking bullshit and DRM and I don't want to live on this planet anymore, we don't even have the details yet. I just want to if you hear my words, please just calm down. Let's wait until we have some actual information from E3.
For the record, I'm not walking around in a rage about this. I'm very passionate about it. And I mean, like, I'm angry about it if we talk about it. But, like, I'm not walking around, like, fists clenched, Red Bull in hand, ready to, like, storm the wall.
There are some people out there, though. Anyway, so everybody brings up some really good points. And I just want to say, I don't disagree with everything all the time. But in this case, I'm just trying to look at it from the most pragmatic standpoint I possibly can, from business standpoint, the standpoint of in these troubled times, an economic system that is feasible and makes sense for the overall health of that ecology. And like I said, I'm willing to see what they have to say. A big issue for me this past generation and going forward into the next generation has been an issue of respect. How much I feel like the platform holder has respected me as a consumer. I feel like Microsoft has not been the one Xbox Live reasons. And I can totally understand how people might come at it from a standpoint of, they're not respecting me as a consumer here. Like I said, though, I just want to make sure that the other side of that is understood, and that there are actual reasons why things like the things they've announced are the way they are. I fully expect that Sony will probably have, you know, Twitter campaigns notwithstanding, they will have something similar on their platform as well, because it's not platform holder that's driving this, it's publishers and the need for a stable economy.
You guys ready for impressions?
Ready for impressions.
Okay. So anyway, last week I headed out to Santa Monica to go check out Bethesda's new wares. Got to look at a few titles. The first one I was able to see but not play was The Evil Within. And that's the Shinji Mikami-san's new studio, Tango Gameworks, which, surprise, surprise, Gomer Pyle style, is a survival horror style.
Yay!
So Bethesda VP Pete Hines, he's this really charismatic figure. He ushered the press into a room where we watched 2 15-minute or so vertical slices of the game, followed by there was a Q&A with a member of the dev team. Now, the first bit of gameplay showed the protagonist, his name, I wrote it down somewhere, Detective Sebastian. He arrived at a crime scene. There was this huge asylum. There was a squad of police cars that were all parked outside. And, you know, he kind of took his time showing off the detail of the architecture and the environment, you know, the sky map and all that. So the detective, he made his way to the door where there were a number of kind of mangled corpses inside. They were all strewn about. Then after a bit of examination, he goes into a room and there's a bunch of monitors where Sebastian watches his fellow officers being downed one by one by this unseen foe. Then he turns around and is hit and then fade to black. Okay, so... Yes. So then, fade in, first person shot, Sebastian, he's hanging upside down, he's surrounded by corpses on hooks, and there's a little bit of swinging, he finally breaks free, and his walk animation reveals some kind of, you know, physical injury. I think he pulls a knife from the environment, probably from a corpse there, and then he sees this hulking figure doing something, probably a more moral to a body in front of the big... leather face type guy. So he starts sneaking his way, trying to make his escape, and then the butcher brings out his chainsaw, he starts revving it up, and he's swinging away at the hero. And next, you know, we kind of witness, this was a playable part, a game of cat and mouse, and kind of demonstrating a cover mechanic, and moving around very Splinter Cell-ish before Sebastian really just a narrow escape makes it through a trap of revolving shredders. And then at the end, he prolongs his safety by hiding in lockers, Metal Gear style, but no bikini girls in there before the scene ends. So to me, the sequence seemed a bit scripted, but managed to channel kind of the sensation of the fear of watching a horror film pretty well.
Does he next use tank controls?
I didn't get hands on, but I'm trying to.
Because I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how
could,
is this?
You could later on you could shoot and move at the same time. So I don't know. But I didn't get a hands-on, but that was one of the questions.
I gotta say, I'm glad for the upswing in detective survival horror genre. Like, it seemed like it took a lull for a while.
Okay, we'll touch on that, because the next sequence was totally different. The first one was definitely inspired by Saw, Hostel, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but the other one was rooted more kind of fantastical monsters. This time, you started in this darkened basement, you were pursued by these vaguely zombie-like creatures. And the other section was defensive. This one was definitely offensive, showing Sebastian shooting beasts in the knees and then lighting them on fire before they got up. But it seemed as if the AI was pretty tough, because the developer that was handling, was doing the walkthrough, he couldn't keep the enemies down, and he ended up shooting him in the head, you know, resulting in this big splash of crimson. The next sequence was straight out of Resident Evil 4. Sebastian made his way to the top floor of, looked like a house there. He looked out the window, saw a horde of creatures approaching, torches in hand, and luckily, he was carrying some proximity mines, happened to have those in his pocket, which he placed on the sides of the windows, killing things as they kind of poured in, and then shooting off any stragglers there. And overall, the game, this part of the game, looked good, if maybe a little too close in spirit to Resident Evil 4. The developers were pretty tight-lipped on the story, said a lot of the gameplay really hinges on the story aspects, which caused me to ask about replayability, because if you play it once, you know, you've seen the story, what else is there? And for that, they said the experience, even though it's fairly linear, the combat itself is pretty open-ended, so the fun is in the combat, deciding what tools to use to kill different creatures, or presumably to sneak past them. I asked him how much stealth is in the game, but I didn't get a definitive answer there.
So Robert,
does
it feel like a successful amalgamation of those game types that you mentioned, or does it feel sort of unoriginal?
A little bit of both. Okay. It feels... You know, there are original elements, and it did feel visceral, but at the same time, I wanted to see more. It did feel very rooted in survival horror tenet. You know, it was just like, okay, there's this and that. And I wanted to me, and this is more of a personal thing, I wanted an experience that was maybe a little bit more open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Okay. That's me. It did look a little scripty.
But it sounds like it could be worth at least checking out.
Oh yeah, most definitely. And look, pretty, you know, if you play it in the lights with the lights out, it could be pretty frightening. So let me bring up my notes. So War Inspector, Deus Ex, Deus Ex,
and, Deus Ex,
Deus Ex,
Deus Ex.
And what's the other game we worked on? Epic Mickey, 1 and 2 fame. He had this to say about the next game. Did the world really need another Wolfenstein game? Do we need a generically dark, monochromatic FPS kill the Nazi giant robot game? No, the world did not. So I am so tired of stuff like this. So what he was talking about, and I played a complete level of Wolfenstein. I guess you'd pronounce it Wolfenstein.
Wolfenstein.
Yes. And Wolfenstein. I can safely say that Wolfenstein. New Order isn't. It isn't groundbreaking by any means, but it is a very solid, you know, first-person shooter. And I think one of the things, the element that was most memorable, because it was most surprising, is that New Order has some, actually, really has some good writing. I don't want to wreck the moment for anyone, but they showed an interactive sequence with a conversation that felt right out of Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, complete with kind of, you know, intriguing but slightly comical villains, but very menacing, and a really kind of build of suspense, a really good, you know, ratcheting up the suspense. It was
so
good enough to
Waltz makes a
yes. It was very. It was like the female equivalent of Christoph.
Nice.
It was good enough to make me ask, what the hell is this doing in a Wolfenstein game? So here the premise is of the game is that the Nazis won World War II. Now I thought that they were going to mix 60s history with this parallel reality, which would have, you know, offered a nice setup for Nazis on acid and maybe hippies napalm. Like, I really want to see hippies with napalm. But instead, not quite as cool. It went the route of the National Socialists have this tyrannical rule over the world. And it, naturally, it's up to one man, army. What's his name?
God, they won?
Yes.
Blazkowicz.
BJ Blazkowicz to stop them. Now, Bethesda reps, they repeatedly told us we were going to die a lot. And that the game, even on the normal setting, was going to be very hard. And I really didn't find this to be true. Single player only. They have no ambition. And I applaud them for this for multiplayer. Just, you know, single player game. And as long as you took it slow, used a liberal amount of lean to kind of pie the corner, I never died at the hands of enemy fire. And this was on a one over the normal difficulty level. Where I died in the game, and kind of repeatedly was in the puzzles and jumps. There's one section of an elevator and there's the counterweight, and I wasn't on the counterweight, and I don't know, maybe I'm a meathead or all these elements needed a slight tweaking. I jumped a lot. I missed a lot of jumps. I won't go into details, but we'll say that the game delivered some nice firefights. A lot of showcase locations. One of my favorite was this dome where they had this huge moon model that filled kind of the core of the room. Players kind of blasted their way up these walkways that corkscrewed around the satellite, and occasionally you could blast off the tiles, and so they kind of, you know, fell off, and you could shoot through those. There were some destructive environments. Not everything is destructive, but they're still working on that. But definitely one I'd like to play. Not nearly as bad as Spectre would say. Probably even better than Epic Mickey too. Oh. Ooh, I went there.
That's pretty good.
You know what I would really like to see? This is kind of off topic, but yes. You know how sometimes in conjunction with a release of like a major, you know, game, they'll sometimes release a sort of smaller, bite-sized, sort of semi-spin-off experience?
Yeah.
I would love to see a remake of the original Wolfenstein, you know, the sort of stealth, you know, Nazi marching, you know, get in costumes, get grenades and stuff like
that.
You're
talking about the 2D version.
Yes, the actual Apple II version of that. I would love to see somebody like touch that up or redo it or re-release it or something like that.
Put it out in 3D?
No. Redo it via, I mean, you could do it in semi 3D or something like that. But I mean, make it true to the original experience.
All right. Okay.
You know, sort of a Bionic Commando rearmed kind of. You know, kind of redux, I guess. But, you know, I don't know. I don't even know why I said that out loud. But anyway, that's something I'd really like to see.
Yay. Interesting kind of iPhone app. Mm-hmm. So also this week, played a few things. Played Field Runners 2 for Android, which is a really good tower defense. You know, right now, I believe it's still on sale for 99 cents. And just the, you know, if you think the tower defense genre has kind of run its course, this one brings a number of nuance. My peeve with the original one was that the maps were all kind of open. A lot of them had open fields, and so you'd make this kind of template labyrinth where you'd delay them as much as possible. And this one has kind of winding roads and does different things. There's even a puzzle element where you try to have the field runners walk through lasers. Nice sense of humor in the kind of loading screens. Loading is a little bit long, but you know, actually some good funny writing on the load screens. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but one of them is about planes or being exploded by landmines. Just deal with it and have fun. It's kind of thing. It's like, yeah, it doesn't make sense. So this week, as I mentioned before, playing a little bit of Call of Juarez Gunslinger, which is a game that resurrects the franchise out of its piss-drenched grave. First game and Bound in Blood were solid, you know, definitely an incline. And then the Cartel just abandoned the Wild West and gave us a modern-day shooter, which was just generic and janky. And luckily, Techland, they've really brought it back on track. One of the best things about the game is its framing device. The protagonist, he tells these stories in flashbacks and occasionally becomes an unreliable narrator, so you replay certain sequences in different ways, and it sounds cheesy, but it works. And so in execution, the storyline is really solid. It sets up different villains, and you get to meet some of the notables of the Wild West, so really a lot of fun. Now, of course, this wouldn't be very fun if the core mechanics weren't in play, and fortunately, they are. There's a lot of player upgrades. There's three, I can't really call them tech trees because they're more revolvers. There's tons of exploding barrels, and even the enemies comment, "Wow, there's so many explosive barrels around." so they kind of, you know, make fun of it. There's a good supply of weapons. Shotguns feel very visceral. There's bullet time. Dueling is fun. I mean, it all comes together really nicely. And as I mentioned before, I often complain about the lack of new publishing methods in gaming. You know, how that $60 game is just in place, and then, you know, if it doesn't sell, then cut it down to $20. But for the second time after Blood Dragon, I think Ubisoft just provided a great 6 or so hour experience, backtrack free. You know, very fun, visceral, $15 download, and which ends before it gets stale and tiring. So. Really liked it. I would suggest people check it out. There is a demo on Xbox Live, and you don't have to sell your soul to play it.
I heard that there was kind of an interesting sort of Prince of Persia-esque kind of storytelling.
The first one or the second one?
The flashbacks?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's all like, told flashbacks and
where it like changes or something. Like
yes, yeah. It changes. He's like, no, that didn't happen at all. Because he's telling, I don't want to give too much away. He's having a conversation with a number of people, and he's a bounty hunter, and there was dime novels that were created about his legends. And then he says, oh, is that what the dime novels said? Let me tell you what really happened.
Nice.
And, he kind of goes back in time. He's like, oh, Billy the Kid, he did this.
Does that like contribute to anything in a meaningful way? I mean,
it's totally fun because you're doing one thing and you think, oh, that's the end of the level. And then he says, nah, that's not how it happened. And then, you know, you go back and it alters and it changes, you know, everything. And it may change into, like the first one, you walk into a barn, you shoot them, and then it becomes, I don't know, like a different firefight.
Yeah, I find it kind of funny sometimes, and just generally speaking, not just in this particular case, but sometimes I find that the things that are charming and clever in one implementation are the kinds of things that someone else would say, oh, they're just artificially trying to drag out the game.
This does not feel artificially drawn out. I would, you know, probably balk at that, but
artificially,
you know,
trying to draw out the game.
No, it's really cool because it's told in flashback. So as you're doing it, he's kind of talking about the experience.
God,
I know that sounds so cheesy great. And it sounds very...
it's not that Bastion. I didn't like the narrator.
Bastion? You don't like the narrator from Bastion?
Well, it's not that I didn't like the narrator. I just...
I'm sorry I brought that up, Jeremy.
No, it's all right. It's just
I just threw Jeremy under the bus.
No, I'm that's okay with it. But the thing is that I don't have a problem with the narrator in Bastion, but it was not, by a long shot, the most impressive or cool thing about that game. It got the most attention, but I think it was the most overrated aspect of that game.
Well, maybe it got the most attention from the same people who are going to buy the Xbox One, but the narrator is still a wonderful.
They're like,
it may not feel as novel or fresh to you, Jeremy, but you know, I enjoyed it. It was a nice variant from, hey, I'm doing this. Here's the setup.
Yeah, no, it totally could. I'm not saying that it does or doesn't. I just could.
The first person shooter genre is a little creaky to me. They're not, you know, giving a lot of innovation,
right?
And so almost any little twist or tie to make the story immersive and have fun with, hey, I'm latching on to.
I was just thinking in a darker Star Trek timeline, Goatee Deagle would be saying, you know, like, oh, they're just, you know, reusing assets to make this 2-hour game into an 8-hour game or whatever.
Goatee Deagle.
Yeah, well, you know Star Trek and the Evil Universe, you know, whatever the.
All right. No, if they do this 3 or 4 times.
I dropped a Star Trek reference, so sue me.
It's not that you dropped a Star Trek reference, it's that like 5 different things sort of got smooshed together that all, like...
Okay, can I just say I saw Edge of Time and I did not enjoy it. Or no, Edge of Darkness, I'm sorry. Edge of Darkness. About time.
You did not like Edge of Darkness?
No.
Mirror's Edge? Fuck that game.
Hold on, wait. You're talking about the new Star Trek movie.
Yes.
Into Darkness.
Into Darkness, whatever.
Okay.
I tried to forget about it. I liked
it a lot better.
But it was a disappointment from Abrams. That it was a big. I haven't seen it yet, but I heard it was a big action fest.
No. Somebody questioned the use of lens flare. For a while, I was bored, so I started counting lens flare.
I kind of noticed that too. Isn't it Michael Bay though who has the lens flare? No, maybe it is.
No, it's an Abrams.
He's babes.
Yeah, there was some lens flare.
Never stay still.
From my part, I liked it a lot better than I thought I would.
Your standards have been lowered, Jeremy.
Well, the thing is, I couldn't remember.
Sure,
I
used to it. Non-goatee Jeremy.
Maybe I have a goatee, so maybe I am.
I know. Capable. That's why I said that.
Non-goatee Jeremy. No, but
is
I.
Jeremy?
I could be. I may have flipped the script. No, but I couldn't remember if I liked the first Trek movie, because I liked it when I saw it. But then shortly after, I started to have some... You know how I sometimes do where I'll just find some little problem that bugs me and then I make it into a bigger problem? So months after it released, I was thinking, gosh, maybe that wasn't really a very good movie. And that's the state that I was in when I saw this. And then I really ended up liking Into Darkness quite a lot. So.
Okay. Before I pass the baton, let me say one movie I really liked, Place Beyond the Pines. The Place Beyond the Pines.
The Christmas.
The Place Beyond the Pines. What's his name? Ryan... Who's the
Gosling.
Big... Ryan Gosling and, God, I'm bad with actors. Bradley Cooper. Bradley Cooper, too. Really good film. Breaks a lot of tradition. You may think, you know, you watch the trailer and you think, oh, I've seen this movie. Classic melodrama. But really, really good movie. I liked it a lot.
So what genre is it?
Drama.
Romance.
Romance. No.
So not a movie.
No. It's a drama. Police. Roma, I guess.
I wish I could quit you.
I can't put it in a genre. I don't want to wreck anything for you.
I don't want to.
Check it out. It's a little small, little more of an indie film, but really good.
What was the name of it again?
The Place Beyond the Pines.
It's not on Brokeback Mountain, is it?
Jesus.
Ava Mendez is in it.
Ah!
Is that a counter actresses to the actors. Brokeback Mountain thing?
There's no counter to
it's not a Brokeback Mountain thing, is it? Well, Ava Mendez is in it. Well, obviously not, though.
There's no Jake Gyllenhaal, so take a star away.
Oh, goodness.
Anyway.
That's not how it ended.
I'm going to move on.
Let me go back and tell you how it really went.
Oh, no. So
we're going to do that at the end of the show.
Speaking of experiences, I have been playing in the last 2-3 weeks quite a few PlayStation mobile games. And I just want to editorialize for just a minute because the first one that I played is called Rimmed Capsule.
I'm sorry. Who chose that name?
It's Swedish.
For anal sex? Is it Swedish for anal sex?
Swedish. Maybe it's rhymed capsule. I don't know. It's R-Y-M-D-K-A-P-S-E-L. Rhymed capsule? Rimmed capsule?
Rhymed.
Rimmed?
I don't know.
Anyway. So, rimmed capsule. It's really neat. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because there's a lot of publicity lately about the indie space. And I just want to say that there's kind of a difference to me between the like chosen independent studios and independent, you know, developers and the people who are actually out there making to little fanfare, little neat experiences. Rimmed Capsule is it's a PlayStation mobile game and it is a super minimalist, kind of space building sort of game. It's got a little bit of an RTS kind of spin on it. It reminds me a little bit of Darwinia. Did anybody play Darwinia on PC or on Xbox, where you build very simple little structures and then the little Darwinians kind of, the little representations of little green men kind of have their own little, life of their own. Think of something like that in outer space, building the International Space Station out of Tetris blocks. And it's really cool. So you start out with a little stockpile of resources and energy, and you then are given much like Tetris, you have literally exactly the Tetris shapes. So your L block, your reverse L block, your square, your straight line, they're literally Tetris shapes, tetrominoes. And when you place them, and it's all touch-based, so I played this on the Vita, but when you place them, you get to place either corridors, which are just little walking spaces, or specialized structures that build sort of in your standard RTS trope your resources. So there are little resource asteroids on the space grid, or you can build an energy solar panel generator. You can build a garden. You can build a kitchen that turns the garden into food, and then you can build defense turrets. And the idea of Rimmed Capsule is that you can sort of play around with it if you want to. It's kind of open-ended in that you basically just need to try and survive as long as you can, because every few minutes there will be a wave of little bad guys that comes in and flies over your space station, and they'll try and kill your little men. And the men are made up of these just little white, they're just like little white pixely things. And you reassign them to different tasks, to either be builders or to be engineers to sort of generate resources faster, or you have them man the kitchen to, you know, tote little resources back and forth to make food, or to man your turrets. And you just swipe them. You have your little pool of people down at the bottom. You just swipe them left or right to give them different assignments. And the game does have objectives, so there are four monoliths that are sort of floating out in the corners of the map, and you have to expand your starbase to, you know, connect walkways to those monoliths to start researching them. And as you research them, you get special bonuses, like your guys will move faster, or you may get resource bonuses or things like that. So you have I believe there are three objectives: either to research all four monoliths, to survive X number of waves of these bad guys coming in, because, you know, you just have to quickly reassign people and defend yourself, to do it all in a certain amount of time, or to I think that's it. So either research the monoliths, survive a certain number of waves, and do it all in X amount of time. And if you can do all of that, then I guess you can sort of theoretically win the game, which I did, and I honestly haven't gotten back to Rimmed Capsule since then, but it is a really cool little experience. Again, just very simple, very minimalist. You're just building blocks and trying to situate yourself in such a way that your little guys don't have to run very far because they're kind of slow little dudes. You got to make sure to get enough coverage for your defense turrets. You got to make sure that you manage your resources in a good way. And then, of course, if you want to pass those objectives, you have to be thinking a little more critically about how you're going to be handling all of that stuff. So that's the first game from PlayStation Mobile. Highly recommend Tetris Cross Darwinia. A lot of fun.
Price?
I wanted. It's a little more expensive. It's like $3 or $4. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, honestly, I don't know. In the era of the 99-cent app, there's a lot of stuff that's 99 cents that you can get mm-hmm. on your Android or your iOS or whatever. But I enjoyed it. And, for a couple, $3, why not? It's a unique mm-hmm. little experience, and it's really cool.
Jeremy, since you're an expert of this space, have they expanded the PlayStation Home Arcade at all?
That is the one Except thing that I actually haven't done anything with that yet myself. So I haven't heard that they've expanded it, but they actually did. Wasn't it Capcom that had a bunch of stuff in that?
Intellivision, some old Mattel. I bought Astro Smash, and there might have been Capcom or.
Yeah, if they've done anything with that, I haven't heard about it. Honestly, PlayStation Mobile is an area that kind of gets a little bit neglected. In fact, actually, between PlayStation Mobile and, honestly, the PS Minis, which used to be a space that I really liked to play in, I don't mm-hmm. know that they're even releasing any Minis anymore, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So they did recently just eliminate the publishing fee, I think, for PlayStation Mobile. So theoretically, we'll see some more activity there. How that's going to work for licensed stuff in the arcade, I don't really know. What's happening with PS Minis, I don't really know. But there are still, in addition to the stuff that's on PlayStation Mobile, there's a lot of really good Minis out there, and you may just want to browse through. If you have, make it a habit. If you ever have $2 or $3, skip a cup of coffee once a week, get a fun little new experience, fun little game. Rimmed Capsule would be at the top of the list of my recommendations to try out for your first
show. I still play Horde every once in a while. Horde. H-O-A-R-D.
Yeah.
One of my favorite PS Minis.
The Dragon. Wait. Did that come out on Minis? Because that was a PSN game at first.
Yeah, it was a PS3 game, and then also I thought it was a Mini.
Oh, it could be. I know they released it on Steam eventually, but that is a pretty good one. You just get to be a dragon and gets
kind of fun. As far as time running.
Yeah, it's exactly. Really fun. Yeah. Sorry, Sage, you were saying?
So Robert's theme is I still play the whore, and Jeremy's theme is
I still am the whore.
And Jeremy's theme is skip the Starbucks, get the rim job. Get the rim. Got it.
Yeah, I actually have a
shirt. We all have our secret pleasures.
From Saints Row 3 that says I heart rim jobs. I have a promotional shirt. This is one reason why I will never play Saints
Row. Have you worn that public?
No. In fact, I hide it as a Yeah, I only wear it on special occasions.
There needs to be some sort of a bet involved.
So listeners now know the special fetishes of two of four of the consistent podcasters.
I don't want anybody messing around in that area, to be honest with you. I don't actually even like to be touched, really. The second game on PlayStation Mobile also is another little independent sort of thing. I think this has been published only on like Kongregate before, but this one is called Haunt the House Terror Town, which came out probably in January, I think, at the beginning of this year. So it's been out there for a little while. And again, not much fanfare for this, but it's actually kind of a neat little game. Haunt the House is more of a more of almost a toy, I would say, than a game per se, but it is super cute. The premise of the game is that you play a floaty little ghost. You basically can just use your control stick to, go your cardinal directions, and then you can hit X to either, do a spooky little ooh, kind of a cute little, ghosty moan, or when you get into the different houses that you're supposed to haunt, you can basically inhabit almost anything in these houses. There are four houses that you can haunt, and they're full of people. And the idea is kind of like what was the game where you could? In fact, it also came out on a mobile platform where you could basically solve puzzles by haunting different things, like haunt the dog's food, and then jump from the food into the dog or something.
Poltergeist?
Yeah. Well, there was Poltergeist on the GameCube, I think.
No. Over the Genesis, Poltergeist.
Oh no! I was thinking
Haunted. Featuring Poltergeist.
I was thinking of something a little more recent. There was something that came out on the DS. What was the DS game that? Anyway, there was that, but then there was also
Ace Attorney. It was put out by Capcom.
Exactly.
Ghost Trick.
Yes, that's right. Ghost Trick is exactly right. And then there was actually Geist on the GameCube, now that you mentioned it, that had kind of a similar idea. So this game is, and it's got a cute little art style, very fun little animations. They've put a lot of work into it. It's sort of set in kind of a roaring 20s jazz era kind of environment. And all the people, so the idea is that all these people walking around the house, you float into the house, and you basically have free reign to go anywhere you want to. People are just wandering around, and you inhabit your ghostly presence into anything. I mean, there's tables, you can inhabit the tables, there's stuff on the tables, like flower pots and things like that, and anytime you inhabit something, you get a little context-sensitive button that you can press to do something spooky with it. So if it's a telephone, the telephone might ring. If it's a chest of drawers, there might be a little hand that comes out. And it's just a simple little animation, and if you happen to be doing your spooky thing next to a person, they might start to get a little bit creeped out. And they'll start to, like, their eyes will narrow and they'll kind of, their teeth will chatter a little bit and they'll keep walking by. Mm-hmm. And if you do it again to another person, they might, like, cover the side of their face, like, I'm not acknowledging this. And I don't know, I've never really found that there's much rhyme or reason to this, but you can sort of follow someone around as they wander the house and kind of creep the heck out of them. And then that fear sort of spreads, and there's a mood in the house that goes from sort of, you know, casual laid back to, like, sort of creepy, and then the mood changes to, like, scary and then terrifying, and you eventually scare people enough that they run out of the house, and that's it. And there's, like, 20 people to begin with, and you basically just try and spook them out of the house just by, following them around and trying to build on their scared state until they finally flee. And it's just kind of really fun to play. Like I said, there's no timer on it. It's just sort of fun to kind of play around. And half the fun is seeing all the animations of all these little things that you can do. Swinging chandeliers back and forth, you know, playing a piano without anybody there. And it's just fun to go in. And as the terror level of the house raises, you can actually do, you know, second level, or even I think some of them have a third level, a spooky thing you can do, like there might be a cello, and the cello starts out by just playing the bow on the cello, and then eventually it turns into I can't even remember what all it does. It, like, flips around and eventually it explodes or something like that as you get more of this terror power or whatever. And there are sometimes people that you can do away with. You can actually kill some people, and then they go into your ghostly, you know, menagerie, where you can then play as that ghost to go and scare more people. So in that sense, like I said, it's more of a just kind of play around kind of thing. So like I said, I would probably classify it almost a little bit more as a toy, maybe, than a game per se. But just really charming. It's one of the best little PSM games that I've seen. And there can be a good range of, in terms of the production value of these things. But this could almost, if it just were a little bit more well fleshed out, if they had more levels maybe, this could almost be a full Vita or PSN title. It looks really good. It's really impressive for what it is. And so that's Haunt the House Terrortown. Again, that's a little bit, I hesitate to call $3 or $4 a premium game, Jesus Christ, but it is another $3-$4 game on PlayStation Mobile. So that's the second little indie game that I've played in that space. Last one that I played from PlayStation Mobile is not necessarily what I would call an indie game. It's a smaller game, but it is called Unama the Puzzle. I don't know if anybody's heard of that, but it is actually, believe it or not, a Match 3 puzzle game based on the Holy Invasion of Privacy, What Did I Do to Deserve This Badman? Where I think they call it No Heroes Allowed now is actually the name of it. Unama is actually...
Warner Brothers played the bad guy.
Yeah, I guess they did. I'm not sure if they actually had a suit brought against them, or if they just sort of decided, you know, we may not want to...
No, they were threatened.
Did they actually? And they probably, well, they should have been, actually, but... I mean, what did they want?
Parody!
What did they want to happen? A little interesting piece, the reason it's called Unama the Puzzle is because the Japanese name of that series is actually Yusha no Kusei ni Namaikira. So it's Unama. So
nice pronunciation.
Yes, thank you. I've been practicing. The idea of this Match 3 game, actually this in terms of the cross of this and that, this is actually kind of a cross between, I would say, like Critter Crunch and puzzle league, kind of. So the gist of this game is that you have a grid of your blocks. The blocks are either did any of you play any of the No Heroes Allowed games?
All three.
Okay, yes, I love this series. I love the way that it was just so different, building your own dungeon, coming up with your own little, you know,
learning the ecosystem.
Yeah, like, coming up with your own algorithm.
Flower. How do I make the flower? And how do I stop all my little worms dying out and make my little whatever sword man and dragon.
Deagle says, the idea of the original game was that you would start to build little monsters, and then you would start to build bigger monsters that would eat the little monsters, and then those bigger monsters would maybe fuel the ecosystem to get even bigger monsters. And this was all done to the end of preventing heroes from invading your little underground dungeon as you dug little blocks. So it actually carries over that theme pretty well, in that the blocks in this Swap 3 puzzle game they're all represented by either blobs or the little buzzing wasp things or the lizard people. So they basically represent the different monsters from the original game itself. And as you match three, those monsters will sort of upgrade and turn into other things. So you're actually upgrading the blocks on the grid. And while you're doing that, of course, there is a hero on the far side of the screen who is marching to go and to try and hunt down Badman, sort of protagonist, antagonist. I mean, you're a bad guy in that series, so he's your sort of dungeon master, I guess. So they are marching, trying...
Sympathetic villain.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Anti-hero. So they're going to go and bring him back. So you have a limited amount of time, and every time you match three in this game, not only will it upgrade those blocks, but those little monsters will go and attack the hero. The hero has a life bar, and every time you dig with your pickaxe, the hero has a chance to throw some unpickable blocks into your board. So you're sort of doing the dual thing. That's why I said it's like Critter Crunch, because you're sort of building up to the larger, the more robust kinds of blocks, but then in Puzzle League fashion, all new blocks are dropping down all the time, and you can swap them up or down. If you leave an empty space, they'll wiggle for a second, and you can actually slide blocks over to do, you know, vertical, or of course you can get your horizontal. So I know that was really complicated sounding. I don't know if you followed me through that or not, but it actually works really well. And I think of the PlayStation mobile games that have come out recently, I think this one, I had the least expectations for this. I thought it was just going to be match three puzzle game. I mean, you know, how could that be? But it actually turns out that it was really pretty cool. And so it's one of those games that starts out slow, like the very early levels are very easy to do really well, and you kind of wonder, gosh, where's the challenge going to be? But it gets pretty hairy pretty quick. Like I said, it does justice, I think, to the IP. It does list Acquire at the beginning, so I'm assuming that they themselves probably did on it.
I was just going to ask that, if they had a original.
Yeah, they just have a splash at the front, so I'm not sure if they are the developer or if they just get credit as, you know, I don't know if they're
creating the characters.
Yeah, exactly. The general idea, like I said, of it works out really well. You can burn up a lot of time on this. I've played it quite a lot, and it is of the mobile games that I've just talked about, it is the most expensive. It actually launched, I believe, at a half-off discount of $3. It is now the full price, $6 on PlayStation.
Woo!
But no, Bad
Jeremy, why didn't you tell me when it was $3?
Bad Man Gotta Eat is all I gotta say. So, I didn't tell anybody, did I? I really should probably have told more people. I'm sorry, that's my fault. You gotta decide how much you want the Bad Man, I guess. So. So really quickly, let me just hit on a couple of other things. I know I've taken up a lot of time. I did try out the Vita version of Ratchet & Clank Full Frontal Assault.
Yes, which, 21st, I saw that.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you and I did get a chance to play once. I think we talked about it on the show.
Yeah.
I will say, I want to try and keep this in the right context, but let me put it this way. I feel like PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale spoiled us in terms of, perfect ports. This game is not the same. If you go in expecting like a Battle Royale quality port where it's literally like the big boy version but on a small screen, the Ratchet & Clank Full Frontal Assault on the Vita is framey. It does get choppy. And there's kind of a weird darkness factor to it, which
this is after they delayed it for 3 months.
Yeah, well, and I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what it takes to make something like that happen. Which is, I was really expecting it to be literally like the PlayStation mm-hmm. Stars thing. I thought it was going to be like literally the same thing, but right. apparently that is, you know, maybe a little easier to do on a, you know, 2D
fighting game.
Yeah, 2D fighting game, but
yes, indeed.
The core game mechanics are the same. It is cross play, so you can play the Vita version with the PS3 version, and I believe it's also cross-buy. I don't know if it's still going on, but if you purchased the PS3 version before this came out, you definitely got a copy of the Vita version, just include yeah. that purchase.
And if you get it on disc, it's buried within the in the menu. Under
yeah,
the
so that
bonuses. Might... So look for the disc. I'm sure they wouldn't separate that.
Yeah,
those two markets.
Yeah, that might be. Like I said, I just the only reason I expect that it's still cross buy, but I don't know for sure that if you buy the digital version of the PS3 version, if you still get this, or if that was a limited time thing. I don't think they've said anything of that kind, but I just don't want to say yes, you get both, and then turn out to be mm-hmm. wrong. But yeah, the darkness is really weird. Like all the characters, like everything is just sort of toned down. The stuff that's glowing is still like normal brightness, but everything else is dark. I don't really
know.
It's
weird after they delayed it for a couple months.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's probably
hopefully the Ratchet and Clank the HD. Which one was it?
Well, Deadlocked is the
Deadlocked. So, yeah,
that's the other thing is as the sort of mea culpa for leaving for taking so long to get it out. You also, and again, I don't know if this is still the case, but you would also get the HD version of Deadlocked on the PS3.
Yeah, still the case. They're still working on it.
Yeah. So my bottom line on Full Frontal Assault for the Vita is that if you played it and liked it on the console, I think this is good. I don't think that Full Frontal Assault on the Vita by itself makes a great first impression. I mean, the game as kind of a MOBA sort of Ratchet and Clank kind of game is a little bit hard to grasp to begin with. It's something about it seems even more difficult to grasp on the Vita. Like maybe it's just that it's smaller or darker or, you know, choppier. I don't know what it is, but it seems like if I didn't already know how to play it, I would probably feel a little bit lost on the Vita version. So it's good if you played the console version and then kind of want to take it portable, because it's fully serviceable. I mean, it works. But
sold me on that one, Jeremy. It
well,
works.
I'm just being honest, because I'm not always super positive on everything. But here mm-hmm. there are definitely some concerns.
Did Insomniac, were they behind the Vita version?
No, the Vita version was out. I mean, I'm sure they worked in conjunction somehow. Sure. I mean, I'm sure there was some assistance there, but it was done by a company called Tin Giant, I believe.
Okay.
And you know, on the Insomniac streams, when they would demonstrate it, they said that they were pretty pleased and it was turning out really well. Of course, maybe they were obligated to say that, but like I said, it's not exactly the same. Like you can sort of tell sometimes the animations are a little bit different. I get the feeling rather than for PlayStation All-Stars, where it feels like literally exactly the same assets, the same everything, just smaller. I almost feel like they had to rework the game for the Vita in this case. It's just kind of my hunch. But in from that standpoint,
because Ratchet is 10 polygons.
Yeah, well, I mean, like the geometry doesn't quite work the same way. There's the collision is a little bit different. Some of the animations are a little bit different. So
that seems like it would be really wonky for crossplay then.
I haven't tried. You know, that's the thing is I haven't played it online yet. The unfortunate thing is not a lot of people played it to begin with, even on the PS3.
Right.
I would like to try it online with someone on the PS3 and see if it, you know, makes a big difference. But generally speaking, like the crossplay stuff on the Vita has worked pretty flawlessly. So I don't think that because it's smaller that the networking is bad or anything like that. I think the most difficult thing here is going to be the choppiness, the frame rate, and then that weird darkness. I don't know why that is.
So you're saying it's not the size, it's how it's used.
It is the motion of the ocean. That's exactly.
Gotcha.
And then forgive me.
I was going to bring up the darkness too.
The darkness too. one last thing I want to mention again, just because not many people have been talking about it, playing some Soul Sacrifice on the Vita as well.
Yes.
Which I don't know if anybody else has been playing that to squeeze that into their conversation, but well, maybe if you do, you know, I guess you already went, but. Let me just, again, really quickly, because I don't want to take up all the time, but it is most comparable to Monster Hunter in that there are hunts where you have certain mission objectives, and they're all instanced, where you go to a certain map, and you might fight little monsters, and you're trying to get big monsters. The thing about Soul Sacrifice is that where in Monster Hunter the idea was more about gathering and collecting and combining, Soul Sacrifice has kind of an interesting theme of what I would call consumption. Everything that you do in this game is an ability that you can load into your profile or your loadout. And, pardon me. And then you basically take those into battle, and you have a limited number of uses of those attacks.
Yeah.
They're more interesting, I would say, than in Monster Hunter. In Monster Hunter, you have a pretty known quantity of, you know, quick attack, heavy attack, charge attack, and then different weapons.
Yeah, they're just fun, like rolling up into a big ball and taking out enemies.
Yeah,
and
that's the thing. So in this you have...
The only thing I found was some of the airborne enemies. I couldn't get a lot of attacks to work with them. And correct me if I'm wrong, before you venture on a hunt, on a mission, it doesn't really tell you what you're going to be facing?
Well, you're right. I mean, in some cases, it will tell you that... you don't really have a good idea of the specifics of the monster.
Right.
But, you know, the same thing is true in, like, your Monster Hunter 2, though.
Okay. I would have liked to have seen that. Like, tell me what I'm going up against. That way I can prepare my loadout accordingly.
Yeah, but a lot of this, too, is on replayability. You know, like, you're going to grind kind of the same way you do in Monster Hunter to get certain abilities. And then you can level up those abilities if you have two of the same, claw.
I just find myself angry at the... airborne enemies.
Yeah.
I kind of have to lure them in. And
that's the thing. They'll usually swoop down. I mean, there's a way.
But
it has gathering attacks and things like that. And then there are also passive abilities, just like you have in Monster Hunter. So where in Monster Hunter you would have armor abilities and things that come with, gathering or... if you do your meals in Monster Hunter and you get certain passives, same thing applies here where you can load yourself up with a special ability, Dark Ritual, I think it's called, or you can, fill up your tattoos on your arms with different passives to kind of do different things. This game actually deserves probably a little bit more discussion, so maybe I'll bring it up another time in the future, but I feel like it's one of those things that probably should be getting a little bit more attention than it is, because I think it's kind of needed. It does have a little bit of a... What was the game with Garcia Hotspur, the demon hunter, the Suda
50? Suda's game.
Yeah, I can't think of it right at the moment. But you know how those kinds of games...
Before Lollipop Chainsaw.
Yeah.
Shadows?
Shadow something.
Shit.
Shadows of the Damned.
Yes.
Shadows of the Damned. Or even Shinji... Because this is a Mikami game. So you talked a little bit earlier about something he's working on next. But this kind of does have a little bit of that kind of overly self-aware kind of... I called it bone pile chic, kind of, where everything is like...
Bone pile chic.
Yeah.
That's nice. I like that.
Like piles of skulls and things, and it's
It's
not funny. It's like, oh, these skulls are really piles of skulls, and it's serious business.
Except, what's the book's name?
What is his name? It's Langer or something like that. Yeah. Some kind of weird.
He's really well written. He's
he does have kind of a British
as a animated menu come to life. He's about as fun as they get.
Yeah, it's true.
But that was really a creative idea.
So from that standpoint, it does have that slightly a little bit too self. I guess I said self-aware a little bit earlier, but I meant self-important or self-serious. It has kind of this self-seriousness to it, and the monsters.
No, I don't think so, Jeremy. Because the book kind of offers a little, yes, the environments, but are a little dreary, and I don't know, they have that the tones that they use and things like that, but the book, he kind of pokes fun the storytelling elements.
You're absolutely right, but I don't think that changes the fact that it's like, oh, you're in this cage with these bones, and there's blood everywhere. Serious. This is so serious. The other thing is that the monster designs, I have to say, they kind of have... If you ever played Folklore on the PS3...
Yeah, one of the early PS3 titles.
Yeah, which is really good, actually, by the way. But where the monster designs are kind of like...
Amalgams of mythology.
Yeah, like this guy's a giant jack-o'-lantern.
But with three eyes.
Yes, or something like that. Like, really? Whereas Monster Hunter is like a semi-believable bestiary of, lizard creatures and, apes and things like that.
Where is Sean when the praises of Monster Hunter are being sung? He'd be weeping with joy.
He's probably playing Monster Hunter.
Probably.
Comparatively, I think the creatures in Monster Hunter are a little more interesting and a little better fleshed out, I think. Mm-hmm. I That could be convincing.
Jeremy, you're being too hard on the game. I thought they were creative and they're fun.
They are. They are definitely. So, like I said, if the monsters and the creatures of folklore were you know, something that, you know, stuck out in your mind, you might like it. It's not that it's bad. Like I said, I think this is a great game, and I think it does some interesting new kinds of things with that Monster Hunter-esque sort of formula. Mm-hmm. But now we've talked about it enough, I probably don't need to talk about it again, but that's generally the gist of it. I think Soul Sacrifice is one of those things that people didn't really get a good idea of what it was, and mm-hmm. and also I don't know that it's really received a lot of promotion, necessarily, no. but the idea of consumption is kind of a neat idea. I think some reviews for it, I've seen people talk about choice in this game,
yep.
and I gotta be honest, I think consumption is maybe a better way to put it, because I guess you could choose... Like, I'm going to use this thing up, or I'm going to apply this to something else. But I think it's more about what am I going to use up in order to get some ability or get some power to do something else to get this other thing. So whereas in Monster Hunter, it's more of an accumulation kind of idea. Mm-hmm. In this, it's more like everything that you do, you're going to burn through. You're going to use up all of these attacks. You're going to have to find something else. You're going to get more attacks from completing missions. You're going to get new kinds of passive abilities. But everything, you're burning through all of your stuff to get new stuff. And I think that's the interesting idea of Soul Sacrifice. The other thing about it that it does a little bit better, I think, in my opinion, than Monster Hunter is the multiplayer aspect, mm-hmm. which is the AI plays a lot bigger role in this, whereas in Monster Hunter Ultimate, Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate, you sometimes get a little helper, a little nut boy, whatever those guys are called. Little...
Nut boy.
Yeah, you know the little guys I'm talking about. With their
yeah.
Those mm-hmm. cat-like things? Or
no,
whatever?
No, no. I guess they have those too. The what are those called? Felines. But
in, name,
yeah. Yeah, but I was thinking of the other little tribal guys in
like the pawns from Dragon's Dogma.
Yeah, kind of. In this, you can have companions that kind of get a little more interesting because they can revive you. You can choose to consume them instead yeah. and get different abilities and things,
or heal them.
Yeah, or heal them to get
by giving by sacrificing a little bit of your own life energy.
Yes, part of your yeah. exactly. Yeah. So that's the thing. So like I said, my thing for Soul Sacrifice, I think better than talking about like, oh, the choices are so permanent. They are kind of, but then you could just go grind for more stuff. For me,
and take the book's teardrops and kind of backtrack.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the other thing is this right. this little funny book eyeball guy. He has these little tears that you can get that when you use one of the dark rituals, for example.
But you use touchscreen to grab his.
Yeah,
tool.
You do.
Crud, and you know, your crud.
Yeah, you look around with the you know, the gyroscope and look around your cage and see how serious all this bone pile is. But it's really serious.
See that skull on the ground?
Yeah,
it's going to be you in just a matter of minutes.
No, that's serious. It's just like that. It's just like that. But it does also have, to be honest with you, the music is really good in it. I've kind of, the more I've been playing,
yeah.
it has a really interesting score. I want to get it out of context and kind of listen to it. And then also, I've kind of been digging the story a little bit. Like, it is kind of a yeah. Japanese-y sort of, like, some stuff makes sense, some stuff is a little bit too... You know, like I said, too self-serious. Like, it kind of, you know, tries a little too hard. But I've kind of been...
I don't know what you wanted, Jeremy. You wanted what? Giggles?
There's just something about... And
you wanted clowns?
I love...
Belly laughs?
Listen, I really love the way that the games that come out of Japan can be super creative, and they do things that we never even think of. All we have in the West is, like, Tolkien, right? That's the only thing we do over and over again. Out of Japan, they come up with way cool and interesting ideas to do... Just all kinds of different spins on stuff.
That's not true. What about detective drama? We do that.
We do some of that. They do some of that too, though.
We got cyberpunk.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Not sure if we
look
own
at
it.
You hating on America. Why don't you go live in Japan, huh? I like it so much.
Jusha no kuse ni aikida.
They're too serious.
They are a serious business. But I have kind of.
They have ample tentacle porn.
They do. They do have that. That's
I heard that.
With many creative.
Sweet.
So anyhow, like I realize I have taken so much time this week. Thank you so much for listening about all of this. I just felt like some of this stuff needed to be talked about. I don't see a lot of people talking about any of those PlayStation mobile games. I don't see anybody talking about Soul Sacrifice. I don't see anybody talking about Ratchet and Clank. I just wanted to make sure that we did here on the Tech Gaming Podcast.
Oh.
Yeah.
And Jeremy.
Mm-hmm.
Did you be a good little Jeremy and download Blaze Blue Continuum Shift Extend from PlayStation Plus today?
I went to the PlayStation web store and I added it to my account. I actually think I've run out of space on my Vita though, so I'm not going to be able to play it. I am actually almost finished with Ninja Gaiden Sigma Plus. Which actually turned out much better than I thought it would. Just generally,
it really did.
Just delete Rim Job and you'll be fine.
Yeah, actually, I'm keeping all of those little PlayStation mobile games. They're like 30 megs each or something. But yeah, almost finished with Ninja Gaiden. Speaking of games that are totally self-serious with a lot of boob jiggling.
Boob jiggles!
It's a little embarrassing. I'm glad it's on a portable so my wife can't walk in on me in the room and see like this boob jiggling. I'm glad I can hide under my covers with the boob jiggles.
I thought when you're doing jumping jacks, she sees boob jiggling.
That somehow seems more wrong that you're like, hi, what are you doing, honey? Nothing.
Boob nothing. Jiggles, they're jiggling.
Yes. Hit the home key.
That seems wrong.
Somehow. So hopefully I'll be able to clear out some space on my Vita. After that, I need to go back and finish Stranger's Wrath, which is the other one I told myself I would finish. And once I clear those off, I'm sure I'll have lots of space.
Whenever you have space, give me a holla.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm going to kick your ass with Noel.
We can play some of that. We've still got Marvel vs. Capcom. We can still play lots of good fighting games.
Yeah. We need to have another tech gaming Vita night or something like that. We've only had one, and it's not enough.
Yeah. I don't have a Vita!
Get a Vita!
No, I can't afford it.
You know what? Just don't value it enough.
You know what? I'd rather buy new games than buy...
You know what? The Vita is so good, you want to get a second job for it.
No, because now I have to get a Wii U.
Well, it's a small one, so you'll just get a part-time additional job.
Okay, who's going next?
Me!
Okay, me.
So first I'm going to talk about the good, and then we'll talk about the fucking atrocious. So
we already talked about Xbox One.
Oh, but there's more. not Xbox One. But I won't start there. So, I played Cognition Episode 3. I don't want to be redundant, but I know that some people listen to the podcast who do not read the reviews. I wrote a review. You can check it out if you
just
want.
Jeremy.
On our way. Yeah. So for you, Jeremy, since you don't read the reviews.
Except on techgame.com.
You're fired!
They're too self-serious.
You hate reviews. So The Oracle is the third episode in the Cognition series. Some people have accused us of being so complimentary about the series because we now sort of have this working relationship with Phoenix and with Zay. But that's not true, Sai.
There we go.
I always get that wrong because I see it spelled and then I'm like,
it's true.
No,
same
way.
Here.
But that's not true. I mean, part of the reason we don't take money is because we want to be able to give honest reviews. So, like always, if I'm actually giving it a good review, it's because it deserves a good review. So, it does deserve a good review. It's a great point-and-click detective game. There are some mechanical failures to it on the character movement. The backgrounds are gorgeous. The painted animation style backgrounds are really delightful. And one of the aspects of the game is that there are paintings in the game. Mm-hmm. And the paintings in the game actually look, I mean, they don't look like Van Gogh, but they look like, you know, you can discern what's there. And they're like a nice painting. And some of them are actually really interesting. Like there was two paintings in this game that I was like, I want a copy of that. Like I would hang that in my room.
Can I just say something? I didn't like it as much as you to counteract. I found that the narrative, it's rooted in this deep self-important, yes, Jeremy.
Self-serious
detective drama.
Why?
And a number of things kind of pulled. Yeah, a number of things kind of pulled me out. Little things like when lead character Erica Reed pulled out the police tape. Did you notice anything?
Well, yeah.
It sounded like scotch tape.
Yes.
And we all know police tape is not adhesive. So when you pulled out,
but those things are really little things.
Okay. The opening sequence, there's a body that jumps off a building, so I'm not spoiling anything, onto a car. All right. There's blood, there's glass all over. Nobody notices it until she does something. I won't ruin the puzzle, but until she does something, and all of a sudden everybody's flocking to it. Nobody notices a body that's mashed on a police car.
No, that's not true. No, it's not. The thing that she does that gets them to notice whatever is not about the body. It's about an object that fell with the body. They absolutely notice the body.
Deagle, why do you need
indies? No. Until she does...
Police show up. They deal with the crime scene. The point is, it's the middle of the night at this hotel that's sort of ritzy, so it's sort of secluded from where gawkers might notice it. Like, it's one of those
reshaped... It's a high-rise building. Everyone's going to be looking out their window because there's a body.
No, but the body's not... The point is that they... I don't want to quibble, but I feel like you missed part of the narrative because they say that they got rid of the body pretty much right away because the hotel's policy is they don't want onlookers, and it's not, like, adjacent to the street. So you'd have to be a resident at the... It's not even a hotel. You'd have to be a resident at the high-rise towers to be in the area at all. And so the reason that they don't initially have the police lights on and everything is so that onlookers and gawkers will not show up and notice. And it's the middle of the night, so there's not, like, ample people looking out their windows and hanging out. Most people are probably fucking sleeping.
Yeah, but when they've heard, like, this ginormous crash sound or possibly a scream on the way down.
No, but what you guys are missing is that the building is... For the aspect of being a rich kind of place, the building is intentionally set apart from other... when you walk to the building, you can see there are no buildings immediately surrounding this building. And you don't... Bodies falling on cars make a noise, but if you're sleeping and you have your windows closed, they do not make a loud enough noise that you would wake up, probably.
It's a big city, bodies rain out of the sky, nobody cares.
Right, and everybody's jaded, so okay. Then there's that.
So anyway, aside from Deagle's...
Are you speaking from experience with that, Sage?
No.
Aside from Deagle's irrational hate, let's talk about Cognition Episode 3. What did you like about it, Sage?
What I like about it is that it's a very... and then, Deagle, feel free to go back to criticizing. What I like about it is that it's a very compelling detective story. Where they fail in those minor mechanical kind of clunky things because they don't have a lot of money and they're not a huge company, I feel like they really excel in creating... You know, the first episode, I don't want to spoil things, but I feel like at this point, it's the first episode...
I haven't played it. La, 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 la.
No. I'm not going to give away specific detail. I'm going to give away a general detail. Right. At the end of the first episode, Erica fails to save someone super, super close to her. I won't say who it is.
Spoilers. Super close people from the...
Well, there's several
people. Her mother, her sister, her lover.
Anyway, somebody. There's a slight spoiler announcement there. But even though that happens in the first episode, they manage to keep this sort of amped level of... they manage to keep the drama really high. Like, they manage to keep it... Yeah, tension, but also they manage to make it seem like there's a reason she'd continue to be invested. I mean, even though in successive episodes, the people at risk are not necessarily as close to her as in the first episode, they manage to make it so that you feel like she really... Not just because it's her job as a detective, she has a personal stake in continuing to follow this trail. Mm. And part of it is because it's all sort of interconnected, but part of it is also because they do a very good job of... nuancing little details that keep you and the character Erica interested. They also are really good at their use of... The voice work's great. I mean, I come down hard on voice work usually, but the voice work's really good, and that and the music combined...
Music's good, yeah.
Do a really good job of creating those feelings of suspense and tension. So even though there's not like a timer to solve puzzles, because you couldn't have a timer in detective games, you still feel compelled. It's not like, you know, Monkey Island where the compulsion...
There's a timer in some things in the first episode.
Yeah, there is one moment where there's a timer, but in general, like for the game overall, there's not a timer. And I think that
there was at least two moments.
I don't think so. Probably. Anyway, not really the point, Robert, quibbly, semantic-y guy.
Let me ask you, though. So one thing you said was it keeps you interested in the episode. One thing I've been kind of curious about this series is, you know, they're doing it episodic, which is something that not a lot of... I mean, I guess Telltale does episodic, and there may be someone else. But how do you feel that has worked out for them in terms of just the pacing of the different episodes?
I think it's successful. I think that where it succeeds is that it's a nice, like, you get excited for the next episode, and they manage to keep the tension going from, like, you know, episode 2 ends and episode 3 begins, and that pace that episode 2 introduced as sort of a cliffhanger is right away there. So it's not like you need this build-up. Whereas when you have brand new games, that's a new plot, or, you know, like sequels, I feel like you have to start at a beginning point, which can't be at the peak of tension. But because this is a continuing series episodically, and it's all the same sort of event that just occurs episodically, you have this continuing tension that makes you like, oh god, I want to play the next one, and then it's really easy to start at that high tension level without exhausting the player.
Yeah, good. Actually, I felt that was something they did also in, like, The Walking Dead very well, too.
Yeah,
but I'm glad to see that they've been successful with that here.
And the other nice thing is that because they have not yet worked out all of those, it's not huge glitches. It's like characters move kind of wonky, and every now and then, not every now and then, but like there's some aspects of the control schema that are a little, you know, sort of just not quite there. I feel like those would get tiring if it was one longer game, but because it is episodic, you sort of, it's like a really mild hindrance that you kind of get over, and the game's not long enough to get you really frustrated with those parts of it. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoiler it, but also the puzzles are really pretty good. And whereas in the first two episodes, I felt like I kind of saw the solution to all the puzzles, sort of number three kind of flipped that. Like there was at least one puzzle where I fucking had no idea how I was supposed to solve it for a really long time.
You emailed me.
Well, I got because they told me to email them if I got stuck so that the review didn't take forever and ever. Robert, did you not, without going into what it is, did you not have that problem with any of the puzzles?
I did, because the adventure game mechanics, I like adventure games where you go to a point and everything is available to you, especially because you are a detective. Uh-huh. And there were some things where you had to backtrack. Once you got new information, you were able to go to a certain space and then new things would pop up. And I wasn't used to that. I figured she's a detective. She would notice something standing out of the environment.
Right, and that is something that is a little one of those mechanics.
I understand what they do. Like, adventure games can either, you know, then it becomes inventory management. That's not really fun.
Right.
But then again, this was a little frustrating because I was like, wait, I've already been there. I've checked that. And then I got new information from a person. I went back and, oh, voila, something appeared.
Right, and that is a little bit frustrating. But those little frustrations aside, I think overall their mastery of creating an ambiance and a suspense is really good. And I think that as a company that's growing, they will figure out how to balance those things out. Robert, did you have any other problems with it particularly?
No. I'd like to. I'm not quite as high on it as you are.
What, her inappropriate humor?
No, not so well. Her cursing does, but that was in previous episodes.
That bothers you, her cursing?
She's an FBI agent. She's
never, whatever.
I thought she'd have a cool kind of detached demeanor, but instead she. I don't know, that's probably nitpicky too.
She's a redhead, man. They're fiery.
Stereotype.
Redhead.
Redhead. Yeah, Blue. You should play it.
Somebody say gingers. No. I would play it, but my laptop overheats if I watch a YouTube video that's like longer than 10 minutes.
Put it on top of an ice pack and play the episode.
Yes, but on top of your 360, just melt it into a blob. Blue, you're up.
Hey, that's me. Oh, crap! I did it again. Seriously, I'm not trying to keep that line going. I revisited Tekken Tag Tournament 2 yesterday, and I've forgotten how good that thing is. Okay, so one of the lackluster trends of fighting games this generation has been a lack of content. You know, I mean, you know, Street Fighter Cross Tekken had... you know, the on-disc DLC characters controversy, and, you know, Street Fighter didn't have, like, a ton of stages and what have you. And it's just, when you play Tekken Tag Tournament 2, it's got about 30 stages and about over 50 characters, and it just makes you sit back and wonder, why the hell can't every company make a game like this? Mm-hmm. You've got, like I said, 50 characters and a healthy offline selection as far as modes go. And like, I'm primarily an offline gamer because, you know, I don't want to pay $60 a year for live because it's fucking bullshit. Okay. Not going to go on to Xbox again. So for me, I mean, just being able to, you know, take two characters and jump into the ghost battle, which is an endless series of fights against the computer. And of course you can exit out if you want, but you know, you pick two characters and whatever your lead character is, they can get costume items and character selection panels and what have you unlocked if you win these special like item bouts, which after every fight, you have the choice of three different opponents or teams of opponents. And if one of the teams has a gold background, if you win the fight, you unlock something, and it could be something stupid like a piece of ice cream for them to hold while they're fighting or something like that. But when you think every character has unlockables like this, the replay value of this, it's 3 digits worth of replay value at least, as far as hours goes. I mean, this is a game you can probably play for about 500, 750 hours if you really, really wanted to unlock every single piece of content for every single person. And of course, you have to buy a lot of shit in here, too. Tekken 6 and maybe 5, the prices are rather outrageous. So if you are a completionist and you want to get everything for everybody, you might start growing gray hair before you finish that mission. when I look at, you know, what Tekken Tag Tournament 2 offers, you know, it's like, you know, I don't have any problems with calling it, you know, one of the greatest fighting games of this generation, because there's so damn much value to it. And, you know, I mean, of course, if online's your thing, it's plenty to do with it. But for me, you know, I'm an offline gamer, and I'm tired of getting stuck with, ooh, it's an arcade mode and a versus mode, and, oh, hey, you can train if you want to, and that's it. That pisses me the fuck off. So when, you know, games like this, and another great one is, you know, like I mentioned earlier, Blaze Blue. That is a phenomenal game if you are a single-player fighting game fan, because there is a shit ton to do in it. And all of my favorite fighting games from this generation have had a lot to do, a lot to unlock. And, you know, some of the games that I've put down quickly have been, you know, Street Fighter, which, you know, when you play the arcade mode, that's pretty much that. Nothing else to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't really want to knock Persona 4 Arena, because I really haven't spent a lot of time with it. But until you finish Persona 4 or Persona 4 Golden, you really don't have a lot to work with, because the big part of that game is the story mode, and Arc System Works does great jobs with their story modes. Specifically in Blaze Blue, I mean, Guilty Gear was good, but they really stepped their game up with the Blaze Blue series.
Should we do Indie Outlook right now?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
That sounds like a wonderful plan.
Welcome to the fourth installment of Indie Outlook, that part of the Tech Gaming Podcast where you focus on the efforts from smaller design teams. I'm Robert Allen, and laughing at me is no other than Sai.
Meow.
She is the ultra-talented social media sorceress.
Stop saying lies.
Well, today we'll be peering into our crystal ball to look at two games, and coming into focus first, this is a small game called 8-Bit Night. Sai, tell me about that game.
8-Bit Night. This was developed by Retro Souls. Well, the concept of the game is pretty simple. This is a retro game with pixely art and puzzles. Ideally, you just play the game while controlling two little guys at once. There is a main one, and there is a shadow version of yourself. The goal is to collect yellow pixels. You can jump, you can go up and down the stairs, whatnot. But you've got skulls and weird spikes and, you know, whatever else preventing you.
A lot of things that want to kill you. Yes.
Invisible things. They want to They want to prevent you from reaching your pixels. So that's what you need to... This is the good part, that you actually swap places with your shadow to get to them. So you flip the map horizontally or vertically. Mm-hmm. This kind of reminds me a little bit of Fez. Mm-hmm. And you know, it also brings a lot of fun how you can create and go around the puzzles. Not all the puzzles are fun in games. There are some are really complicated, I have got to admit. And as far as I know, there are about 50 levels to go through.
Yep.
The game is available on the Sura.
It reminded me of the Giana sisters. Remember them?
Yes.
Yeah, reminded me because you could kind of switch through. And the one thing I wanted to say is Retro Souls, they are a one-man outfit from Atelier Russia. Denis Grachev is the programmer behind
the
game.
How long have you been practicing saying his name?
All day and night. I wake up in the morning, Denis Grachev. And so, boom, I have it now. Dennis is probably mad at me because I still wrecked it. Anyway, he was kind enough, jokes aside, he was kind enough to release this game free on Desura to promote his Indiegogo campaign for a game called Air Knight, which is a voxel-based shmup where everything gets blown into little tiny blocks. Just went live.
Amazing proposal.
Yeah, it is. Just went live today on Indiegogo, and I would love to see people support it because it's a concept or I'm... surprised someone hasn't done it sooner. Just looks cool.
One of the things I like the most about the video that he posted is how everything is lined up. Like in the art itself, once you shoot something, it's just coming. It comes down like a piece of Lego or something. It's really cute. Cool. It's like, I love it.
So yeah, 8-Bit Night had a lot of fun. Played about 15 levels. Definitely a puzzler. There's some really devious puzzle designs. Dennis, if you do listen, I want you to know that you drove me crazy. And crazy in a good way. Crazy in a good way. Really.
That sounds, that sounds kind of weird. I hope you're going to edit that out. Because
that's staying in because that's how I feel.
You're giving your man love? Okay.
No, not man love, but he kind of, you know, that fine line between frustration... when you're playing a puzzle game, and then when you finally conquer it, that exhilaration. And so he cultivated those feelings. He stirred those inside me.
But, you know, one of my favorite games from him was Alter Ego.
Yes.
I think he actually released this one back in 2012. Mm-hmm. He's got three games available, I think, if I remember correctly. It's 8-Bit Night, Alter Ego, and Alter Ego Dreamwalker. And Alter Ego, one of the things that I really liked about this one is that, yes, you can jump, switch, collect, and all this kind of stuff. But you also have got the ability to jump on the enemies as well. So it's like a sweet revenge in those fucking skulls. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really do much because they respawn real quick, just like right away. But it's still, you know, nice to have the option to, you know, like, you fucker, you kill me, you die now. And, well, the difference between Alter Ego and Alter Ego Dreamwalker is that the Dreamwalker, it came out this year, and it's way much more complicated than both of these other ones. You've got a limited time in which you can actually switch the map. So every single time you start the game, you just have a little number up the shadow, and it's going to tell you how many times you can do it.
Yeah.
See, that's my dog approving of the game.
Yeah.
We love you.
It got four barks up. Thank you, Dennis. I want to talk about Assault Android Cactus. Now, what's the first thing that came to mind when you heard the title?
I'm not going to go there.
Okay. I thought of a Cactar because... you know, obviously I play a lot of those JRPGs.
Final Fantasy,
the little running, constantly in running motion character from
Final Fantasy. What was it that you said that you pictured it with a little top hat and a...
Yeah, like a tuxedo and maybe a Samsung phone that launched Shuriken out the battery compartment, you know, something cool like that. What I got was something totally different, but still cool.
It's special snowflake.
Yes, I'm a weird snowflake. What I got was something from a three-person development team. They go by the name of Witchbeam, which is another cool name. And they delivered a nice little character-driven twin-stick shooter. And it is powered by Unity. And we got to play a little bit of the demo. There were five different androids. Each had their own kind of custom and distinct loadout. The lead character, Cactus,
she's the main one.
Yes. And she is not as prickly as you might expect. She has an assault weapon. and that you can depend on that works pretty well for clearing out foes. And if you really want to get up close and personal, there is her flamethrower. Holly is my favorite, probably because she's overpowered right now. She's got a lock-on weapon, and
yes,
really
she's also my favorite. I just played the whole 5 levels I did with her.
Yeah, because she just aims in the general direction and she'll take them all out. So bless Holly. You want to describe her secondary?
Yeah, she's got a special move and it's called Cannonball. However, one of the things that we were talking before is that I like it, but the thing is that it's kind of slow. And maybe this, it's a little bit frustrating because when you're using this, it just, you know, sometimes you just run away and the enemies are all over you and the cannonball just still does not get through. But that's the one thing I will have to say about her. She's my favorite.
That's also my special move at the community pool during summertime, the cannonball. Never mind. The cannonball. Where you kind of wrap your arms around your legs and you make a big splash. It's the dive for people who can't dive.
Wow. We'll talk about random books. Sure. That's fantastic.
We do here in Indie Outlook. The last one I wanted to talk about was Starch, who looks like one of the androids from the Will Smith movie, the one that wasn't very good, called I, Robot. They have this really kind of weird blank doll face with no expression, and she brings...
Self-hating on the poor android.
Yeah, yeah, she's cool because she's an android, but just her face is a little eerie. There's nothing there. She has this persistent laser and macro missiles, so she's cool and offers something.
Well, I kind of agree with you. I did get the chance to play with all of them, but I did not like very much the laser.
Yeah.
Micromissile is also very slow. It's like 1,000 little pieces that just goes and flies around and then eventually just go back to the...
Is it because it's not a pew-pew laser?
It's got an animation to it, but still. Hmm. I don't know.
Okay. So right now, the preview build, it shows the campaign, endless battle and boss rush. And right now, we could only tackle the first 7 levels from the main game. But still...
It's got like 25 stages.
Yeah, at least. But it did show some promise. Most of the stages drop you into these really nicely rendered geometric environments that are a little bit bigger. The playfields are a little bit bigger than the screen itself. And there are 2 control options. You can aim and move with the mouse if you're hardcore. You're moving around with the WASD keys. Or if you're like me and a total noob, you use the Xbox 360 controller. Boom. I'm not a sadist. I just got booed.
Why do you have to hate on the keyboard and the mouse? Really, that's the way.
You know, it's not about hate. I love PC games and I love everything that PC. Backwards compatibility is there. No, I love Steam and all that. But the thing is, I was raised as a console
you love
gamer.
Steam?
I do. I love fact that you can pick up indie games for almost next to nothing. It's just great.
I'm not going to say anything just because yeah.
No, I think it's a great plot. Anyway. So anyway, the game's levels are just about the right length. They're maybe 3 minutes. And each of them offers a nice little variation. One of them has, when you go to an airport and you see the arrival flights, there's that kind of board flipping. Well, it does that with the floor, and the floor morphs and changes around. One of them cut the lights, you could only see in front of you, so it was showing off a nice little lighting.
I've got to say, this is one of my favorite dynamic levels, the one that they start playing with the lights, because...
Yeah.
Part of the level you actually, you don't expect it, which is the weirdest part. You're just going around, it's bigger. This one is actually larger than the previous one. So you say, hey, I actually have room to move. They're not going to eat my face. And no, right. It's just everything goes dark and you don't even know where you're coming from. And
then they also shadow the enemy, so you're not completely, you have an idea of where they are. There's also boss encounters. They convert the game into like a bullet hell shmup where streams of projectiles are launched big enemies. And in these, in those stages, it's a little bit difficult to keep your battery drained. This is the mechanic. It combines a health bar with kind of a timer. And really, I only have one complaint against the game. It's the balancing right now. It's pretty easy to run that battery, to drain that battery right now. And that's a little frustrating because you can get very close to the end of the level, and then it doesn't push out a power-up, and so that can bring everything to a screeching halt. The other balancing balancing issue I have is that Holly, as I mentioned, is way too easy to just kick ass. I just send her charging into enemies wildly. So she is a killer.
No, you know, I really don't think that she's that overpowered because, in a way, I think Cactus, her special flamethrower ability, is it kind of compensates the kind of speed that Holly does not have. So you can either say that probably Cactus or Holly are going to be the most popular ones.
Okay.
It reminds me kind of when I was playing with Coral, which is another one of the characters that you can select.
Right.
You do have the option of a shotgun, but I think the shotgun has no range. So you have to be really close to that vision able to hurt them or do anything. Otherwise, you're just going to, you know,
that's why I did like that's why I did like Starch, because she had the range with the laser. Her pew-pew laser reached across the whole screen.
I don't know. I mean,
it was kind of underpowered because you had to fry them for a few seconds before they disappeared. But still fun. I like the variety. And the game's still early. The frame rate is definitely in need of a little bit of optimization. It is on Unity, so it's allowing for easy portability between platforms. And I
they apparently they say that you can unlock 4 characters throughout the campaign as well.
Yeah, multiplayer. So, you know, if they can get that good old-fashioned optimization in, I'd love to see the game cooking at 60 frames per second on my rig. That would be great. My PC rig, not console.
I will stop it. We all know that you don't like PC games.
No, I love PC games, especially. Well,
well, that sounds convincing.
I'm sorry?
That sounds convincing.
No, I do. I do.
Mm-hmm.
I have a whole wall of PC games right behind
me. Sure.
Anyway, I'm not going to defend my alliance to the PC kingdom.
Oh,
I am going to uphold faithful fan Digo. He is.
Yay! On Twitter.
You should follow him. He is at Gunmetal Jackal. That's at GunmetalJackel.
He's the unofficial tech gaming member.
Yes, he's
unofficial. We love you, Digo.
Unofficially a great guy because he contributed 5 games for you to win, 5 Steam games, including Iron Brigade, Toy Soldiers, Deadlight, Mark of the Ninja. Mark of the Ninja kicks ass. That was one of my favorite games of last year. And also, not to discount, Insanely Twisted Shadow Planet, which I like. Now, to win one, put your preference in the show thread, followed by a comment, constructive criticism of the show. And as
come on, you know your haters.
And
we all love our haters.
Yes.
We love you guys. Even if you hate us.
And as well, you should follow Digo on Twitter, because he's
a guy. Yes, he is.
Take
amazing.
A look at his icon. He's got a dachshund that's
cute. He's the cutest.
And, you know, if you don't like that, then I don't know what's wrong with you. So, insta follow. Seriously, did you see that picture?
The special snowflake said that. Well, of course I've seen it. I talk to Diga like every day.
You probably don't stare at the icon as much as I do. I was like, that's a cute dog.
You stare? Seriously? I don't think you've realized all the things you have said today.
I just talked nonsense. And on that note...
Wow. We'll okay, see you guys that's
in
fine.
2 weeks after I control myself.
He's staring at you.
I'm looking at you.
Not creepy.
Not at all.
Not lasers. Oh, God. Let's just end this, please.